It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. Today we discuss the history of one of the most historically foreboding places in the state of Florida, commonly known as just Chattahoochee. With us is historian Sally Link, who's written Out of Mind, Out of Sight, A Revealing History of the Florida State Hospital at Chattahoochee and Mental Health Care in Florida. It chronicles the long history of the institution, and she joins us from Deerfield Beach. Welcome to you, Sally.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you. So the story begins with the Seminole Indian Wars when the site was an army arsenal. Tell us about that and why that was.
Well, it actually began during the Second Seminole War to facilitate building forts along the waterways in order to keep the Indians from settling in that area so that the Americans could colonize the area. And so in order to build the fort and in order for the Americans to come in, they had to kind of get rid of the Seminole Indians who had been sent south with all of the wars that were up in the southern states. So the federal government built an arsenal there along the river, and that facility was finished in about the Second Seminole War started in 1934.
1834.
I'm sorry, 1834.
Well, yeah. What's 100 years?
Yeah, really. And then the war came about 1839 to that area, but by that time the arsenal was there, and so that was really the beginning of the facility itself.
So take us through the early history of the facility from there.
Well, that facility played a role as a federal arsenal during the Second Seminole War, and when that was complete, it morphed into a federal arsenal for the Civil War, because Florida was seceding from the Union at that time, and there's an interesting story that David Levy, who was a senator at that time, had sent a letter up to the War Department asking them for an accounting of the arsenal in the munitions that were in the arsenal. And the gentleman up there realized that he was asking for another reason, because he knew Florida was going to secede. And so he didn't give him the information. And at that point, the Florida militia came in and took over the arsenal, and so for a time it became an arsenal in the Florida as they were in getting ready to secede.
Now tell us more about the Senator David Levy. I think Yulee was his name. Wasn't he also the first and probably the only Jewish governor of Florida?
Not governor, senator. He was. He originally came, and his father had settled into the central part of the state and was actually going to make the Micanopy area the new Zion. And he set up a sugar plantation there, and David actually served on the sugar plantation. So he became very well abreast of raising sugar and so forth, which served him very well later, because he built several plantations up in that area, went into politics, and became a senator. And his name was David Levy. He later changed it to David Levy Yulee, which was his mother's maiden name.
Well, we haven't gotten to the point where it became a state prison, but tell us about Betsy Yulee, who you said is the first insane person to arrive at the facility once it was a prison, I guess.
Allegedly insane.
Allegedly insane.
Yes. At that time, nobody really knew what insanity meant. It's just a difference of opinion as to whether her social skills were in step with the norm at that time.
And what year was this?
Well, that was in the 1860s.
Okay.
So what happened with the arsenal, though, after it was the Civil War arsenal, it became what we call the Freedmen's Bureau. After the Civil War, a lot of the blacks were trying to transition from captivity and slavery into their own, and so this bureau was their go-between with the government to try to assimilate them back into society at that point and give them back their land and just give them any kind of help that they could at that time. So after the Freedmen's Bureau, then it became the Florida State Prison.
Oh, okay.
Tell me, Sally Ling, this hour we're going to be talking about a lot of the cruelty and awful things that happened at Chattahoochee, but to be fair, give us an update of the facility and the way it operates now.
Currently, it has a dual role. It has civilly and criminally mentally ill folks at the facility. And forensic facility means that it takes people who have been deemed incompetent to stand trial and incarcerates them and tries to rehabilitate them mentally so that they can then go back and participate in their trial.
Are there any inmates there now that would be familiar to the public?
Well, no, probably not. If they follow any of the trials or the major trials that for criminals, they might know somebody there. But other than that, I don't know that there would be anybody in particular that would stand out.
That's interesting. So they actually try to rehabilitate them so that they can stand trial.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
One was the most interesting parts of that is that there were death row inmates who had been deemed criminally insane who were sent to Chattahoochee at one time during their rehabilitation process in order for them to become rehabilitated so that then they could then help with their defense so that they could be proven guilty so that they could be put to death.
Well, how were they on death row if they hadn't been proven yet guilty? They were still...
Well, they were proven guilty. They were just proven incompetent to help with their defense. And it's a very intricate and interesting aspect that I just barely touched on in the end of the book. But that was quite an eye-opener to me and quite a kind of a contrast and contradiction. Here these people have been put into prison, have been charged, have been found criminally insane so that they can't actually be convicted. So they're sent to the system so that they can become mentally well, so that they can help with their trial, so that they can become convicted. So it was very interesting.
My head's spinning now.
Well, no, I understand. I'm wondering, do they do this in all state mental hospitals, or is it only in Florida?
I would think that it happens elsewhere, although I can't vouch for that. I only did the history of Florida.
Right, of course.
I'm sure in Texas it's the case. That's kind of like the New York Yankees of capital punishment.
But actually, one of the death row inmates was actually the death row inmate who took his case to the Supreme Court, and they ruled that you cannot put mentally ill criminals, you cannot kill them, that you have to rehabilitate them in order for them to help with their defense, and so forth.
So does that stand, that ruling?
Yes, it's across the country now.
Okay. So let's go back. When the facility became the Florida State Prison, you tell some gruesome tales about that. Can you go on about that for us? Tell us about
that. Well, the prison itself was extremely primitive. There was hardly anything left in the arsenal at the time it was taken over for the prison. And it was very dilapidated. There were hardly any usable items there. And Malachi Martin who had been part of the political good old boy system, was given the distinction of being the first prison warden, and he was not a very kind man. So I think it was like any of the criminals back in those early times in the late 1800s when they really didn't know what rehabilitation meant. All these prisoners were sent there just to be tortured, basically, unless they survived and served out their prison sentences or they died trying. So I think it was just no different than most other places, but Florida came into the system kind of late.
We're speaking with Sally Ling. She's a journalist and historian and the author of many books. The latest is Out of Mind, Out of Sight, A Revealing History of the Florida State Hospital at Chattahoochee and Mental Health Care in Florida. That's today's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, along with historian Sally Ling. We're talking about her book, Out of Mind, Out of Sight. Sally Ling, some of the things that we look as so atrocious and cruel today, I suppose that at the time they weren't thought of that way. But tell us a little about some of the unusual treatments that occurred at Chattahoochee, this business of cold water wrappings and all kinds of devices to essentially to take these people and try and make them calm.
Yes, there were a number of treatments that were used at that time, and a lot of these came up through just experience and trial and error. But cold water plunges were used quite a bit, as well as cold water wraps. And plunging, we mean putting them into literally ice water.
Oh.
And also wrapping people in ice-cold sheets. And they were wrapped like a swaddling baby, so they really couldn't move. And this was supposed to help calm the individual down if they were in dire straits.
How could that possibly calm somebody down?
Well, we can't think of it now as being very calm at all. And it probably wasn't very calming to those people at that time. I think what we have to remember is that mental health care was an evolution, and nobody really knew what mental health care meant. There was no such thing as psychiatry or psychology back in these times. That was an evolution as well, which came out of the medical field. So these folks were kind of left on their own, and the people taking care of them were kind of left on their own to try to figure out something that might work. And one of the greatest things at that time was hydrotherapy, which was warm water, was a very calming effect. But they had kind of torturous types of treatments back there. They had spinning, which spun people around, and they had...
While they were wearing a straitjacket.
Yes, yes, like the front of the book, like the cover.
Right.
And so they had some rather torturous ideas of therapy back then.
So this was what year did it become the Florida Asylum for the Indigent Insane? That's what it was called.
Yes, that was in 1877. But these treatments that I was talking about, a lot of them happened before that time, but they also used them, some of them, up to that time. The spinning went out. That wasn't help. That didn't occur at Chattahoochee or anything. But they did have the cold water plunges and the sheet wraps and that sort of thing. But you had asked me, Bonnie, earlier about Betsy Yulee, and I just wanted to make an association there.
Right.
With David Yulee. When David Yulee had his plantations, he also had slaves, and Betsy Yulee happened to be black. So while I was trying to research this and put the little pieces together, which all historians try to do, I had to try to figure out how Betsy Yulee, first of all, got that last name, which was so unusual, and second of all, try to make a connection. Well, the only thing that I had was a census at the hospital, which said that she was there at Chattahoochee during this time. But when I talked with other historians who knew about David Levy Yulee, they confirmed that she was probably a slave on his plantation, and after emancipation, she took the Yulee name and then eventually wound up in the prison, because that's where they threw a lot of the insane people at the time, because they didn't know what else to do with them, so they sent them to Chattahoochee and to the prison.
So there wasn't any evidence that she was his concubine?
I couldn't find any.
Or that she was insane?
Who knows? There were no records of the early people. The only early records were, which no longer exist because something happened to them, was a list of names of the first tenants of the prison, of one of which was Calvin Williams, who has a little interesting story, too. According to the record, It says that he was 40 when he entered the prison, but according to a gentleman who actually took over the prison, was a captain for the prison camps when they moved out of Chattahoochee and went into prison camps, he said that Calvin Williams was a young boy, and that he was incarcerated for stealing a horse, which was a felony back then, and he was put in the prison, and he was given, because he was so small, nobody knew what to do with him. Everybody else worked in the prison.
So how old are we talking about?
Well, they don't really say, but I'm thinking 10 or 12. And his job was just to carry two bricks from one end of the prison to the other end of the prison all day long and set them down, pick up two more bricks, and come back. And so he did this monotonously for years until he got old enough where he could actually do some work there.
It's interesting, you know, you're a historian and a journalist. You're not a medical professional. What was your catalyst for writing the book, and how involved was this process? It sounds like it was difficult to unearth some of this information.
It was, and it took me years. but actually, the reason why I wrote this book was because I was actually writing a murder mystery, a true murder mystery that occurred in 1948 in Boca Raton. And one of the people that I was researching, her name was Teresa Castiglione. And putting, again, the pieces together, I realized that she had been sent to Chattahoochee in 1932. And so when I called up there to talk to one of the clinical psychologists about her and why she was there, her records were no longer available. What I found out, I was trying to find some background information on the facility. And this gentleman said that there was no such thing. There wasn't a book on the facility. I'm thinking, this thing started in 1877, and no one has ever written a history of this facility? So I said, okay, I guess I'm chosen. and that's really how it started, because of Teresa and what I was trying to find out about her.
And did you find out?
Mm-hmm. Boy, did I. and basically, that led me, and the murder mystery together led me to find her daughters, who are still alive. They're in their 90s and 80s, and I knew there was a connection of why she was there, but I couldn't say definitively. But until I talked with her daughters, and then I knew I was on the right trail. And in fact, she was incarcerated because of a personal tragedy in the family when her young daughter, who was about 3 1/2, burned to death.
Oh.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or question, we're speaking with historian Sally Ling. She's the author of Out of Mind, Out of Sight, which chronicles the Chattahoochee Mental Florida State Hospital at Chattahoochee. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN, and also you can zip us an email, radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Sally Ling, tell us about the racial segregation of inmates at Chattahoochee, but particularly going back to, say, just the post-Civil War era.
Well, as in most places in the South, everything was segregated. Colored folk, what they called them, colored. The black community had its own wing of the facility. It basically had its own area of the hospital, if you can call it that. At one point, they had to operate literally in an office because they could not use the white hospital facilities. So the blacks were...
You mean surgery?
Yes.
Operate?
Yes. Operations were handled in an office.
Oof.
With the surgeon's own instruments rather than there being instruments available from the hospital.
So they had to bring them with them?
The surgeon did,
yes.
And I assume a lot of these things were lobotomies?
No, that didn't come. That came later, although there was still segregation at the time. I don't know whether any of the people who were lobotomized at the Florida State Hospital were black. There is no indication what race they are in my research. That was an interesting time in itself.
Let's talk about that time, the time of lobotomies, and a little history on them.
Well, let's go back a little before that and talk about some of the treatments that were being used up to that time. You have to put this in context. Nobody knew anything about mental illness. People were suffering terribly. They were howling at night. They were mutilating themselves. They were eating things. They were angry and depressed, and nobody knew what to do with these people. And they were all, at this time, put into institutions. So there were thousands of these people in an institution they didn't have any clue what to do with them. So in the evolution of the medical part of this, there was fever therapy, which basically they injected, induced them into a fever, which put them into coma some time, and that alleviated some of the mental illness. How, I don't know, but they did away with that when they started also insulin shock therapy, where they'd give them insulin injections to the point where they'd go into a coma and then they'd give them sugar. And somehow that alleviated the mental illness to some respect. And then there was metrazole, which was a chemical, and they injected that, which did the very similar to insulin, but it worked faster. Let's put it that way. It worked a little bit faster. But they had terrible side effects because they would be going into shock and they would jerk, and actually fractures would result from this. So that wasn't a good thing either. And then they went into the ECT, and that was the shock therapy, electroconvulsive shock therapy. And that really was kind of a miracle device for them. A lot of people were helped and cured with the electroconvulsive shock therapy. During that time, they also, lobotomies began. And Walter Freeman and James Watts were the first to perform lobotomies in the United States. I think he probably became a little hot dog guy, not serving hot dogs. He just became a gentleman who kind of went off on his own and hot dog lobotomies throughout the country later on. But
in what year was this?
Oh, this was in the 1930s.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. And at the Florida State Hospital, Dr. James Lyerly was a studied lobotomies because he wanted to help. He was a neurosurgeon from Jacksonville who came over to the hospital who wanted to assist the mentally ill, and he started performing lobotomies. But in his defense, I have to say that unlike James Watts and Walter Freeman, who tried to perform lobotomies on anybody, Dr. Lyerly had a very strict treatment regimen, and these people had to fall into certain categories of mental illness before he would even touch them. And according to Dr. Sullivan, Edward Sullivan, who was a partner of his, and who's still alive, by the way, who's 93, and who I was able to talk to regarding the lobotomies. He assisted Dr. Lyerly in performing lobotomies at the Florida State Hospital, and he said that many people were helped by the lobotomies. I'm not advocating them. I am telling you as a historian that you have to put things in context. When there is no other treatment and they're trying things to try to help people, this particular treatment did help many people.
Were there ever any charges against staff members? It seems like with all of this going on that there must have been some tremendous cruelty and possibly sexual offenses. But were any staff members ever prosecuted? Or
if there were sexual offenses, I did not find records of them, and I probably wouldn't, because those would not have been put into the state history.
Right.
But they probably existed.
Oh, I believe they probably existed, because we do have some records of births being performed, babies being born at the hospital. One thing I want the audience to understand is this was not just a mentally ill facility. I'm telling you, anybody who had a epilepsy, tuberculosis, who was elderly and had dementia of Alzheimer's, who had unusual medical illnesses, they were kind of all sent there because that was the only, they had a hospital there, a medical hospital there, as well as an institution. So that facility really became kind of a conglomerate of patients who had all kinds of illnesses, not just mental illnesses.
We're speaking with Sally Ling. Her latest book is called Out of Mind, Out of Sight on today's Topical Currents. Another break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman along with Joseph Cooper. And we resume our conversation with Sally Ling. Her book is History of the Florida State Hospital at Chattahoochee. It's called Out of Mind, Out of Sight. Sally, I know you have a website where people who've tried to find records of relatives and that have written to you. Give us that website.
Well, there's actually, my website is sallyjling.com. And there are, if they Google Florida State Hospital, there are a number of websites that they can go to. The genealogy group has done a great job of trying to locate patients who died there and who were in the graves.
Unmarked graves.
Unmarked and marked graves, both. And so they can just go online and Google them, and they're very helpful.
In fact, let's take a call about that issue. This is Mary Gay in Southwest Ranches. Hi there.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just would like to know, you did answer it just now. You can Google it and go on the website. If you were looking for someone and you wanted information on them or their records, you just can Google it and then get on the hospital and track it that way.
Well, DCF is really the channel for getting information on any former patients, but that is very difficult unless you are a relative.
Department of Children and Family.
Right. Unless you are a relative, they will not give you any information.
Okay, but if you're a relative, then you can?
Yes, but you need to contact the Department of Children and Families and go through their division in order to obtain any records. But I have to tell you, I don't know what years the records are available, but I know in some of the cases where records that I was looking at, had been destroyed.
There must have been some very terrible untold stories that occurred in that institution.
Yes. In fact, throughout the entire research that I did, periodically there were great upheavals and things that went on, terrible things that went on in the hospital, and investigations done by the state into allegations of abuse. And yes, they did find many allegations to be true. They found, in fact, one gentleman who had died as a result of some of the beatings that he was taken. Now, one of the favorite things was choking out of the patients if they were giving the staff a hard time. They would just choke them out until they passed out. There were cases of being beaten, physically being beaten. There were cases of having keys heated and pressed into the palm of the hand. There were cases of aprons being stuffed down people's throats. So yes, there was all kind of abuse that happened there, and I think that was a result of several things. One, frustration at not even knowing what to do with these people or how to treat them. Number two, the staff was terribly, they were understaffed and undertrained throughout the entire history, old history of the facility, not today's history, but older history of the facility.
Tell us the story of Kenneth Donaldson, which you relate in the book, and the business with the Thorazine and not having a writ of habeas corpus.
Yes. Thorazine, first of all, let me just say that there were, in the 1950s, there were almost 7,000, in 1960s, there were 7,000 people at Chattahoochee. Now, that's a lot of people.
7,000?
7,000 patients, close to 7,000 patients. And there weren't anywhere near the amount of medical personnel that were needed to take care of them. So sometimes people never saw a medical person for a year. So Kenneth Donaldson comes along in the mid-1950s, and his parents have him committed to Chattahoochee. He had been in some hospitals up north, mental facilities farther north, and so he comes down to visit his parents, and while he's here, they have him committed to Chattahoochee. Well, he spent 15 years in Chattahoochee, and he never was able to talk to anybody really about why he was there and why they were keeping to him. He obviously claimed that he was not mentally ill, and he wanted to get out, naturally, but he kept there for 15 years until finally he was able to obtain an attorney who actually sued the two doctors that were treating him. And as the case went through the courts, he kept winning. At the time that people were incarcerated into the mental institutions throughout the country, they were done without any kind of medical knowledge or medical intervention or medical anything. A lot of these people, if my father told me that I was insane, he had the court sign a petition, and that was it. I was sent away. One case I found of this lady, she was sent away by her father because she had charged this was in the 1800s, had charged something on credit, and she had failed to pay it off, so her father sent her to the mental institution because it was embarrassing otherwise. But anyway, back to Donaldson. So he took his case and won in Florida, and then the two physicians took the case to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, and he also won there. And that was a landmark decision, and that is where throughout the country now, you can't just on a word or a whim incarcerate someone for mental illness. There has to be a system and a process that people go through in order to determine that that's where they should be.
Such as the Baker Act?
Well, it's interesting. The Baker Act and Donaldson were paralleling each other. Maxine Baker, who was a representative from Miami, introduced the law into the Florida legislature. And at the same time, Kenneth Donaldson is fighting his battle through the courts. Mm-hmm. Now, I could not find a direct tie, but I believe in my heart the reason why the Baker Act came along at the exact same time was because Kenneth Donaldson was taking his case to court, and Florida didn't want that publicity and that negativity, so they were going to try to get something passed at that time, because they both came to fruition about the same time.
One thing that kind of disturbs me when you were talking about the shock that they would use, insulin shock or that other drug, I forgot the name of it.
Metrazole.
Mm-hmm. And then even the lobotomies, you say that they were actually helping people. What criteria was being used to say that they were actually helping? Did they become like vegetables? Is that what meant that they were?
There were some cases where these people actually went back into society and were able to lead productive lives.
After lobotomies?
Yes, and after these other treatments. Now, I don't know what the medical community was like at that time. I don't know if they established a set of criteria. I think probably in many cases the physician established his own criteria,
right,
as to whether or not they were being helped. The one thing that we didn't mention, though, Bonnie, that I know we wanted to mention that, was Thorazine, which came along in the late 50s. And this was a drug. They called it a chemical lobotomy because it was a drug that literally changed the face of treatment of the mentally ill forever, because that was the first drug that was used to help depression. And from that particular drug came other drugs that we have today that help specific types of mental illness.
Right. We have an emailer. She says that you misspoke on one count. David Levy Yulee, son of Moses Levy, was the first Jew elected to the U.S. Senate. This is Annette saying he was representing Florida. He added the honorific Yulee to his family name to appear less Jewish. Yulee was a title given.
He converted to Christianity.
Right, given to an ancestor. Okay. In addition, his father had hoped to create a venue for Jewish settlers, primarily German Jewish refugees.
In Micanopy.
It was called New Jerusalem, not New Zion. I don't know.
Well, that's semantics.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, that was just.
We're speaking with historian Sally Ling. We're talking about her book, Out of Mind, Out of Sight. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and historian Sally Ling. We're talking about Chattahoochee and her book, Out of Mind, Out of Sight. Tell me, Sally, how long of a research period did you put in for this book?
Well, there were several years, and a lot of the research material, some of it was at the hospital, some of it at the Florida State Archives, some of it was just good old detective legwork and tracking down people and getting their firsthand stories and that sort of thing. But it took many years.
Was there any kind of oral history recordings that you could use? Or?
There weren't any of from the Florida State, or at least I didn't find any. Let me put it that way. I've tried locating individuals. I knew people were there, but they didn't know I was doing a book, so how do you get in touch with people? You know, it's tough to do. I did find some people who were willing to give me stories, and the research on Teresa Castiglione was all just legwork on my part to try to put the pieces together with her to make a case history. One of the things I wanted to tell your audience is throughout the book there are case histories of people who were at the facility, some of which I obtained through the archives or through the hospital, and others which were verbal.
You included that story in your book about the family, one of whom was mentally ill, spent many years in and out of Chattahoochee. Why did you include that?
Well, I put that at the end of the book as a postscript, and one of the reason for that is I had just dealt with all of the historical documents and the information that was written that I could find. What I wanted was really a personal story of somebody of a family who had been affected by mental illness, and what it was like to live with someone who was mentally ill, what the after effects on the family were, what it was like to visit the facility during that time. And I thought her story was very important to the overall look and feel of addressing this issue.
Of mental illness.
Yes, of mental illness and the facility itself. Because I did try to keep the focus on the Chattahoochee facility and its subsidiary facilities.
How does Florida, how did it rate how the way they treated their mentally ill versus other states? Anything you came across in your research?
Well, what I did find was that Florida tended to lag behind the rest of the states in not only observing or admitting that there were mentally ill citizens, but also in building any facilities to assist them. Originally, Florida sent their mentally ill to other institutions in other states, so we weren't even really addressing much about what to do with the people in our own backyard.
They would even pay those state stipends to take those patients, right?
Yes, they would. And any family who wanted to keep their mentally ill person at home, they could also apply for a subsidy from the state that would help them pay for that. And one of the reasons why there became less mentally ill and the state didn't have to pay so much money out is because once Chattahoochee was formed as the state hospital, they no longer paid a stipend to these families. If the person in the family was really mentally ill, they had to send them to Chattahoochee.
Let's take another call. We've got Harvey in Key West. Please turn your radio down.
Yes, I was wondering if you're on trial, you're declared innocent by reason of insanity, so you can't be insane at the same time that you're guilty. And also, I've left my phone with your people. I'd love Sally to speak with you further about this later. It's incredibly fascinating what actually went on. And if someone is going to be executed, if they're declared sane, wouldn't they try to subvert the therapy so that they continue to be considered crazy? Or do they get so disgusted with being crazy that they'd rather be executed and say, I'm sane, let me out of here, let me die?
We're short on time, Sally. Could you address that?
Yes. I think if you talk with anybody who is in the law enforcement system in that area, they will tell you that there are a lot of people sitting on death row who are criminally insane because they do not want to be put to death.
Say that again. They're criminally insane.
Because they do not want to be put to death. If they become sane, they will be put to death. So they retain.
Oh, so they stay criminally insane.
Yes.
I see.
4 years, 40 years, people are still sitting on death row because of that.
We may have some confusion in our conversation, but we had a caller that wanted to remind us the Baker Act was actually implemented to prevent committal abuses.
Correct.
Right. So you had a judge has to. To Baker Act someone, correct?
Yes.
On the advice of a psychiatrist or psychologist?
Yes. Now they have to go through a process in which to be assessed in order to be considered mentally ill or insane and be incarcerated. Back then, they didn't have that.
And it's a 72-hour period, I think.
At the present time.
It seems like the stigma of mental illness has really, really, I don't know if it's been shed entirely, but there seems to be so much more compassion for mental illness now. When you hear about stories that you're talking about and going back to the 1800s, it's amazing the way they're treated now compared to the way they were treated then.
Yes, and understand that the drugs that were an evolutionary process for this really changed the face, because about that same time they went to community-based clinics. And all of these people who were on the edge were let out of the institutions and were now taken care of by the community-based clinics that could dispense drugs and assist them. And that is basically originally in the 70s is where our homeless came from, is from all these people being let out of the institution.
Right.
Tell me, Sally Ling, if we were to take a drive up to the Chattahoochee facility, I think it's about 40 miles east of Tallahassee, could you paint a picture of it, what it looks like?
Well, it's still a large facility. It's got a lot of buildings. They have over 1,000 people that they help every year there, and so you're going to see a much smaller facility, obviously, from the time that it was in the 50s where they had 7,000 people.
Mm. 7,000, that's pretty 7, hard to believe.
7,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. In the back of the book, I have actually... in the appendix, it shows you the number of people each year, how many were retained and how many were let, were supposedly cured and were could leave. And during that time, there were about 7,000 people at the peak.
Mm.
So, but the facility, obviously, is that they're using right now is a lot smaller than what it was at that time to house 7,000.
How do the locals in Gadsden County feel about the legacy of Chattahoochee, the mental institution? Are they kind of sensitive about it? Enough is enough?
I think not so much anymore. There were cases where it originally, when Chattahoochee in the early days, where these people were very sympathetic to some of the people who were there and would help them, but now help them escape, because there were escapes. But now I think the stigma is pretty much gone, because it's a fairly well secure facility and it's very pointed towards the two types of mentally ill people.
Any escapes of note?
No, none in particular.
Sally, you've written a lot about Boca. What's your interest in Boca? You have a history of Boca Raton, small town, big secrets inside the Boca Raton Army airfield during World War II. What is it about Boca?
Well, that's where I first started writing my historical books. But as the stories started growing, I branched out into other parts of Florida. Run the Rum Inn was about Prohibition and all of South Florida. And then, of course, the Chattahoochee is about Northern Florida.
Right.
So it just it's nothing in particular, just kind of wherever I'm led.
That's where you go.
That's where I go.
Well, it's been a pleasure visiting with you. We've been speaking with historian Sally Ling, and her book is Out of Mind, Out of Sight, A Revealing History of the Florida State Hospital at Chattahoochee and Mental Health Care in Florida. Thank you very much, Sally Ling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sally.
And that wraps up today's edition. It was produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. And happy birthday, Richard Ives. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop a like so your friends can find us as well. We also have free audio archives and digital downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program is with Tel Aviv University professor Anita Shapira about her book, Israel, A History. It chronicles the turbulent plight of the nation. Now today's calendar. On this day, 1911, 102 years ago, the birth of playwright Tennessee Williams in Columbus, Mississippi. The nickname Tennessee came from his southern drawl while attending the University of Missouri. The master of the mad heroine theme, he penned A Streetcar Named Desire, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, The Glass Menagerie, The Night of the Iguana, The Rose Tattoo. And on this day, 1930, 83 years ago, the birth of writer Gregory Corso in New York. He was the youngest of the beat writers. One more. On this day in 1945, 68 years ago, the death of David Lloyd George, the only British Prime Minister who spoke English as his second language. Welch. So we leave with a thought from David Lloyd George, Prime Minister during the last 2 years of World War I. Quote, "A politician is a person with whose politics you don't agree. If you agree with him, he's a statesman." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman and our crew. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for The Talk of the Nation.